And you're back to the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And remind you, on the 13th, did I get that right? Yes, the 13th, we will be doing our fundraising for the Taylor Report. But, of course, the station goes to work on the 8th. And feel free to go ahead and start sending support and money, et cetera. Go to the site, CIT.FM. You can always write to us, by the way, Taylor at CIT.FM. FM, and we're on the web, taylor-report.com. Today's April the 6th, and I will mention that this is the anniversary of the assassination of President Habyarimana of Rwanda, and we all know that happened in 1994, and terrible things resulted. As a word they always use, all parties says it. The assassination triggered the war and massacres of civilians that followed. And today, if you go to Global Research, you'll find an article by Phil Taylor and Amadou Dem. It's in reference to Mr. Dem. I urge you to, because Mr. Dem was the intelligence officer of the UNAMIR at the time all these events happened, and he has over the years had things to say. And the article highlights what he has told the world. He's a rather important figure in that he was an officer of Senegalese army, a veteran. He had been in combat. He was also a paratrooper, and he did wonderful work in Rwanda, saving many, many lives. He's an under-celebrated, under-recognized individual, in my opinion. That's why the article appeared today, Global Research. I urge you to have a look at that. Another matter that I want to make sure that we note on this anniversary, or that we just went by, April the 4th, is the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And it is, we've just had the film Selma, and I really think that it's a good touchstone to discuss King and the struggle against racism. But it happens to be also the anniversary of another important date, and that was the entry of the President of the United States into the captured city of Richmond. And that was that individual you might know is Abraham Lincoln. It is, talk about under celebration. Here was a moment when the city fell on April the 2nd. It fell in the sense that Robert E. Lee, the so-called brilliant commander of the Confederate forces, fled the city with his army, trying to survive to go on fighting for slavery. And when Abraham Lincoln learned that the city had been captured, he said, "I'm going." And everyone around him said, "Don't do that." And he said, "I'm going." And he went. And he arrived in Richmond on a boat with his son. It happened to be, by the way, the 12th birthday of his son, Tad. And he had a small party of people with him. And they got out of the boat and met former slaves, and who came up and said, "Who are you?" And they said, "This is the President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln." A very great moment. We'll come back to that. But I think we have our friend Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Thomas?
Hey, Phil. Good to be back.
I tell you, I feel like a guerrilla radio figure. We have climbed the mountain to reach the mountain, and so it's a pleasure to be talking to you. You've written an important article about this war, and Thomas, you're kind of close to it. You're in Eritrea. What's that, about 40, 50 miles from Yemen?
Well, yeah, actually.
As the crow flies?
Yeah, well, if that's across the straits from in Baba Mandeb Strait, but it's not even that far, but I'm up in Asmara, which is about 400 miles away, but across the Red Sea, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, we should probably emphasize that is agreed to be what I call a choke point, a dangerous place to be fighting, because there's a lot of oil and trade goes through those straits. Am I right?
Well, the biggest trading partners in the world are Europe and Asia. And all of that goes through the Bab al-Mandeb. So when they talk about a choke point, they mention oil, but they don't mention the fact that the two biggest economies in the world, the Asian and the Europe, the biggest trading partners in the world, have all their transport container ships going through the Bab al-Mandeb. And the Houthis have been reportedly been putting arms on one of the islands that's close to the Straits, so it's definitely they got the Saudis and the Egyptians worried.
Yeah. And I guess everybody in that neighborhood is paying close attention. You told your readers something that I hadn't realized. You said that in 1990, when they had a previous encounter there, Eritrea was what helped negotiate the settlement. Is that right?
Well, Yemen had been in a two kind. It had been divided into North and South Yemen for many, many years, and they'd been fighting each other, and. At that time, Eritrea wasn't even independent. They were considered a ragtag band of guerrilla fighters, and they got the two sides in the North and South Yemen to sit down and reunify the country. So Eritrea has a history of trying to negotiate instead of fighting, and that's, you know, we know that fighting is not going to solve anything, most of the time, so usually you'd have to sit down and talk.
Yes.
So that's the Eritrea did play that role in 1990, which everybody in Eritrea knows about it, but nobody outside knows about it, or they won't recognize it.
They don't. Yeah, they'd rather not remind the world that Eritrea was a peacemaker.
Yes.
Again, we're speaking to Thomas Mountain about his recent article. You can Google and always find the writing of Thomas Mountain This is clearly, this is Saudi Arabia, and they something, a hubris or the nudging of the United States has caused them, they're clearly involved in an illegal war of aggression, are they not?
Yes. The thing is, the Saudis recently had a new king, and this king is supposed to have appointed one of his sons to the Ministry of Defense. The boy is 30 years old and has really no background, but that's why they've got this new policy now. Saudi always used to be very much behind the scenes, using their money and not getting directly militarily involved. But now all of a sudden there's this new policy, and it's not only in Yemen, in Syria. There's been a massive uptick in Saudi support for the al-Nusra Front, which has resulted in major the Saudi cooperation with the Turkish regime. There's been a major escalation of al-Nusra's front's ability to attack the Syrian army. And you've seen some major captures of Idlib and some other places now, because the new Saudi policy is to be more directly aggressive militarily. Now, this is going to come back to haunt the Saudis.
Go ahead.
Oh, that's why the article was entitled Yemen, Saudi Arabia's Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Because most people don't know that back in the 1962, there was another what they call a coup, outbreak of fighting in Yemen, and Egypt under the general turned president Nasser intervened militarily. At one point, they had over 50,000 Egyptian troops in Yemen, and they ended up having to tuck their tail between their legs and cut and run, because as Nasser said later, Yemen had become Egypt's Vietnam, because it's a tribal conflict there. And the only way you solve these kind of tribal conflicts is not militarily, but through negotiations. And they may be long and torturous, but you have to sit down and talk, and they have to work out their problems.
Mm-hmm.
So now Egypt learned the hard way, and they're reluctant to get involved, but they're beholden to the Saudis now for some $20 billion in financing to keep the Egyptian economy afloat. So the Saudis are trying to drag the Egyptian army into Yemen.
Yes.
But see, a lot of people don't know that the Saudi army is a mercenary army, and it's really ironic that most of the rank-and-file soldiers in the Saudi army are from Yemen. And their officers are Jordanians, and the pilots flying the Saudi Air Force are from Pakistan.
Oh,
the Saudis themselves are actually don't make up the military.
That's a dangerous combination.
Well, and it explains why back in 2009, the Saudis tried to attack the Houthis. And the Houthis, who had been fighting the Yemen government, led by President Saleh, repeatedly been fighting the Yemen government, or battle-hardened. And they have many years of experience, and they're very well organized militarily. They may be lightly armed, but they're fighting on their own home turf, and they know the terrain, and they're very, they're very experienced. 2009, they made short work of the Saudi attack across the border and ended up capturing a large chunk of Saudi territory. Mm-hmm. And the Saudis apparently had to pay them off to get them to pull out of their territory. So, you know, I think the Saudis themselves are reluctant to intervene on the ground. The Houthis continue to gain territory, gain ground, and the Saudis, all they can do is bomb. So I think the Saudis are pressuring the Egyptians to send military. Hmm. Egypt themselves.
This is a case of daring each other. You go get him. No, you go get him.
Well, you know, and Egypt is not exactly, they just, like last weekend, lost 15 soldiers in the Sinai against the insurgency they're fighting in the Sinai. Well, they've got bombs going off in the capital, so Egypt can't even provide security in their own country.
And by the way, there can't be any love lost between the population of Egypt and the Saudi royals.
Well, you know, Egypt's a divided country. You've got the supporters of Morsi and the Brotherhood, and then you've got the supporters of Al-Sisi. Mm-hmm. So Egypt itself is divided, and, you know, it reflects with the instability in Egypt's society. But, you know, to go into Yemen, anybody want to go into Yemen, you know, it's a tribal situation they're going into. And the Western media is trying to portray this conflict in Yemen as a proxy war between Saudis and Iran. And it's simply not. There just really isn't any evidence that the Iranians are militarily involved supporting the Houthis. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Houthis are very well armed and have been very well armed for many, many years now. They don't get their arms from the Saudis. They basically captured or bought them on the black market in Yemen. So, you know, there's this propaganda war going on trying to say that this is a proxy war between Saudi and Iran.
Yes.
And Iran doesn't get militarily involved. The best example is Bahrain. Mm-hmm. Bahrain's an overwhelming, mainly a Shia population, yes, which used to be a province of Iran, and there's never been any military attacks on the Saudi occupational police that have taken over Bahrain, and because the Iranians aren't giving the Bahraini people any weapons. So how mm-hmm. come they don't give Bahrain weapons, and yet they're giving Shia weapons? This is a lot of propaganda. People outside have got to be really careful that they're being lied to about what's going on in Yemen now.
Yeah, the characterizations certainly have been. And by the way, I mean, who's doing it? The Washington Post, the New York Times, they use this language calling people Shia. These are very different schools of Islam they're talking about. And to be recklessly doing it, one has to assume the intention to simply to try to cause Muslims to fight each other.
Historically, the Zaidi branch of Shia in Yemen has not been even considered Shia by most of the Shia. So, you know, it's historically, Yemen has not been a particularly sectarian place. It's a tribal place. Mm-hmm. The problems they're having are based upon tribal differences, not by religious differences. Yemenis don't, historically, they're not like the Saudis, where they've got this Wahhabi fanaticism that sees Shia, anything non-Wahhabi, as being, as being the work of the devil. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more important to kill the non-Wahhabis than it is to kill the fight against Israel or the Christians or whatever. That hasn't been the case historically in Yemen. And this portrayal of this as a religious conflict, again, is a gross distortion of the facts on the ground.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, you pointed out, I mean, the organization that's supposed to be public enemy number one, Al-Qaeda, they are supporting the Saudi attack on the Houthi. Am I right?
Yes, and the fact is that the Saudis continue to support, directly or indirectly, the ISIS, the Islamic State, and Al-Nusra Front, which is basically an Al-Qaeda organization in Syria. And, you know, there's hundreds of millions. I mean, if you look in Syria and Iraq, ISIS fighters are getting paid. The foreign fighters are getting $300-$400 a month. So who's paying for all that? They've got but 30 or 40,000 foreign fighters in Iraq and Syria. And yes, this, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. Who's paying for all that?
It's coming very expensive.
Yeah, it's coming from the royal families of Saudi Arabia and from the Gulf states and maybe even Kuwait. So, you know, when you talk about Al-Qaeda, you talk about basically a Saudi-based organization.
Yeah, it is. We're speaking to Thomas Mountain. He's the title is Yemen is Saudi Arabia's Vietnam. And of course, as you point out, they've already stumbled there. By the way, this war, we're calling it a war. It's an air war to the extent that Saudis are involved. As far as I know, they haven't. There's nobody's mustered an army that is actually moving into Yemen.
Well, that's true. The Saudis have, you know, I have seen reports that there's been fighting on the northern Yemen border with Saudi, and that the Saudis haven't made any inroads into the Houthi territory at all, which is pretty telling, meaning being that the bulk of the Houthi fighters are in the south trying to capture Aden and secure the area. So if the people that are left behind are maintaining their borders against the Saudis, that does not bode well for the Saudi military. But then again, like I say, the Saudi rank-and-file fighters are almost all entirely Yemenis, and they're sending Yemenis to invade their own country?
Yeah. The chemistry of that is something to anticipate. Well, now, they had a meeting. The Saudis like to go to meetings where they organize everybody, and they won't allow certain people to come. I noticed that Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Oman, Algeria, etc., are against this. And yet U.S. and their friends are saying, oh, this is a good thing, and the Arabs are united against the Houthi or against the Shia. But there isn't any unity at all.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what they're trying to portray. The Arab League is trying to portray this united Arab front. But the reality is that, you know, when it comes to boots on the ground, I think Saudi's going to have to depend on Egypt. And Egyptian army is not particularly well-organized or led, or particularly well experienced in combat. They're not even able to maintain security in the Sinai, and yet they're going to be taking 40,000-50,000 Egyptian troops into Yemen. It's going to be a major disaster for Egypt as well. But then again, like I said, you know, just a few weeks before the Saudi war on Yemen, the Saudis and the Gulf states leadership were in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, signing a deal promising over $20 billion in aid to the Egyptian economy. So, yeah. You know, it's not like President al-Sisi of Egypt has a whole lot of choice. He's going to have to...
We gave you that money. Some of your guys are going to have to die.
Yeah, because they know themselves that their own military is not reliable. It's not it's a mercenary military, and they're not going to... it's one thing to send them into Bahrain against defenseless civilians. It's another thing to send them against battle-hardened Houthi fighters that have been fighting for decades in some cases.
Yeah. This is Thomas Mountain. And by the way, one of the important Sunni leaders seems to be Prime Minister Cameron. He's talking very loud about how they have to help out. Do you suppose the British are tempted? After all, this is their territory, right? Aden used to be part of the Indian government of when Britain was a naked colonial power.
Yes, and a sizable chunk of the British economy is military exports, and the Saudis are some of their biggest buyers of British military hardware. So, of course, Britain, you know, will benefit greatly by seeing a lot of Saudi upgrading of their military, replacing equipment. So, you know, Britain's going to want to demonstrate to the Saudis that they're reliable suppliers of British military hardware to the Saudi military. So, of course, you know, Cameron's going to, you know, he's been in Saudi a number of times, making military deals with the Saudis. So Cameron, of course, you know, is going to be supporting the Saudis. But I think the Obama administration, I mean, they're particularly inept in terms of diplomacy. And
I didn't know they had any diplomacy.
Yeah, well, you're almost right about that. I mean, it's been a sort of disastrous series of events. And, you know, the Syria and Obama's infamous red line, we're not going to let them cross. And this military defeats they're experiencing in the Ukraine.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things the Obama administration is not very good at.
Well, can somebody cross the Red Sea besides Moses? I mean,
I don't think the U.S. is all that happy about what's going on there. It's potentially a very explosive situation, and it could spread a lot of problems across the region. And I don't think the Americans are really all that hot. They're forced to back the Saudis. They don't really have any choice. The Saudis have gone ahead with something, whether the Americans like it or not at this point, they've got to get on board.
Mm-hmm.
So, the idea that people are pushing that this is something the Obama administration wanted. I mean, the Obama administration is not happy that the Houthis are coming to power. But I don't think they're all that happy about a military you know, explosion going off in the region either.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, I noticed little or nothing is being paid attention to the actual political demands of this group. After all, they said they wanted a democracy. They wanted a parliament. They wanted a president who would reflect the population of Yemen as opposed to the royals of Saudi Arabia or to other foreign powers. And they tried to deal with this. The president stepped down. This guy stepped down. He resigned. And then the Saudis say, you can't resign. You have to pretend you're the president.
But well, you know, this President Hadi was vice president to the former President Saleh for many years. And the reason the former president chose him was because he had no support base in the Yemeni population and was no threat to him. So when the deal was struck to get Saleh to leave office after the uprisings began in 2011 against him, the deal that was shoved down the Yemeni's throat by the Saudis and the Gulf states, who basically been keeping Yemen afloat economically, because Yemen's about 25 million people. It's almost as many people as Saudi, and it's the poorest country in the Arab world. And the situation in Yemen economically has been growing increasingly desperate. Yemen is running out of oil, which funds the economy. They're running out of water. And there's been major, malnutrition and hunger problems in Yemen. Yemen's increasingly dependent upon foreign food aid just to keep their population fed. So that's something the Western media is not talking about, the fact that all the aid shipments to Yemen have been stopped by the Saudis in this war, and that Yemeni people are starving now as a result of this war. But, you know, that's basically been the problem in Yemen, is that the corrupt government has been, you know, misappropriating the money they need desperately to keep their population fed and surviving. And the Houthis finally got fed up with the politics of hunger in their country and moved on the government. And they basically chased Hadi out and said, look, let's sit down and negotiate. Mm-hmm. And right from the beginning, the Houthis were saying, let's negotiate. And they actually did some major negotiations, major meetings with most of the representatives of the different tribes in Yemen. And that's been ignored by the Western media again. Yes. But the only demand that the Houthis have made that they're not going to back off on, they say Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which has, you know, been fighting, the Americans have been sending drones against for quite a while, killing a lot of innocent Yemeni population, has to get out of their country. Because most of Al-Qaeda and the Iraqi
How about that for irony? Obama's been killing people that he identified as Al-Qaeda in Yemen, and now he's aligned with them, or at least his friends the Saudis are, and he's helping.
Yeah, and, you know, most of those, the real Al-Qaeda in Yemen are Saudi exiles that have taken up home in Yemen. So, you know, the Houthis are fed up with them because they're fanatic Wahhabists that are saying that, you know, killing Houthis is God's will. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, they're saying the one demand they're saying that they're not going to negotiate about is that these Al-Qaeda guys have got to get out of Yemen.
Yes.
And other than that, they'll talk to everybody and they'll negotiate. But the Saudis are not going to tolerate that. The Saudis are particularly...
Houthis are aligned then with the decision of the United Nations Security Council, because we're supposed to all agree Al-Qaeda is a criminal group.
That's right. But then, you know, the United Nations Security Council has been...
I forgot about but then...
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people, I don't think it's exactly difficult to see the contradictions where you could have a fascist coup in Ukraine and a military assault on the Russian population, ethnic Russian population of Ukraine, and Russia cannot come in and intervene and protect these people against the fascist coup with an illegally installed government. And yet in Yemen, you can... You know, it's fine for Saudis to intervene, and so you know, there's a double standard there.
They get a gold medal for that.
Yeah, they can. There's no law. There's the law of the jungle, and only the strong survive. And that's what I think. Eritrea here, we've been forced to maintain a national service military because of the law of the jungle. That we show any weakness, we're going to be invaded by the Ethiopians. So, you know, the problem is in this world, if you're not strong, they're gonna wipe you out, and because that's all that they know is the law of the jungle. And you know, the UN's increasingly a nasty joke. That they can stand by and watch this well, double standard and invasions and attacks on.
I'm glad you touched on it. I'm glad you touched on it because one of the, I thought, embarrassing aspects of that meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, where they basically said Saudi Arabia can commit aggression against Yemen, the Ban Ki-moon was present. Now, he didn't vote for it, but he brought himself there as a kind of anointment of that meeting and the criminal enterprise that they launched.
Yep, that's right. So, I mean, Ban Ki-moon is known as, his nickname in Korea is the slippery eel. So, because he's so hard to pin down. And, you know, he's a slippery eel. He's a pretty nasty character. But then he wouldn't get to be head of the UN if he wasn't.
Exactly. That was, I think, yeah, that's part of the job description. Well, lastly, okay, now you've pointed out, okay, there's a neighborhood issue here. Somalia is a little bit at risk because of this. Eritrea, Ethiopia, et cetera. What do you anticipate? Are they saying anything, these governments? Do you have any impression of what they think is going to happen?
Well, the Eritrean government has been for negotiations right from the beginning, and have been trying to help the Yemenis over the years continue to negotiate to solve their differences internally. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Eritrea is against any sort of external aggression. But at this point, the situation's got so out of hand, Eritrea's sort of having to sit back and just watch it all.
Keep its powder dry.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, you know, we are neighbors to the Somalis and the Yemenis, and Eritrea doesn't want to see any war, you know. But you know, it's just, it seems like our neighborhood. There was peace in Mogadishu back in 2006. The Ethiopians, at the U.S. behest, invaded and launched this war there, and the Americans have been militarily involved in Yemen. I mean, you know, the American military in Yemen had to run away, literally flee, and they literally blew up all their equipment as they were leaving. The stuff they couldn't pull out of the country when they left, when this war broke out, they just blew up. So, you know, we don't want to, Eritrea, we just want to see peace. We want to see everybody cooperate and live together. Yeah. We don't want to see all this fighting going on because that's bad for everybody. But this is, in a sense, the Americans are in favor of this conflict because, you know, it's sort of a situation of crisis management.
Yeah, it gives them an excuse to manage.
Yeah, they create a crisis and then they can step in and loot and plunder and control everything. They don't want strong, independent nationalist governments in power because that'll prevent the United States from interfering and getting their policy carried out. So the Americans, in a sense, they'd rather see Yemen at war than see a strong Houthi government there. Mm-hmm. On one hand, on the other hand, I'm not sure if the Americans are entirely happy with the way things are going with the Saudis these days.
Well, it's kind of interesting to see them break a sweat, begin to a little anxiety. that's when they meddle like this, what do they expect is going to happen eventually? By the way, I mean, isn't it, just to wind up here, isn't it, you've portrayed a problem that if the Saudis can't master the situation, this could be fall back on their leadership asking one another, why did we do that? And you could end up with a different government in Saudi Arabia.
And, you know, I've seen reports that last weekend there was an anti-war demonstration in the eastern Saudi Arabia where the Shia population and the oil fields are. The Shia population were demonstrating against the Saudi invasion and attacks on Yemen. And the Saudi police fired on the demonstration, killed 2 and wounded 30. So right within their own Shia population, I think this is one of the reasons why the Saudis are intervening, because they don't want to look weak and indecisive to their own minority Shia population, which actually is where the Shia live and where all the oil fields are. Yeah. So I think the Saudis are concerned about their own internal destabilization as well.
Well, that's a very important statement. Thomas Mountain, it's a great pleasure to be talking to you. That's a terrific article. We look forward to more articles from you.
Yeah, well, you know, and I want to tell all your viewers out there that the Phil Taylor Show is one of those, you know, ways of getting the truth out there, and they've got to support you. Oh. You guys in Toronto, you know, you got to dig in your pockets. Times aren't easy, but without people like Phil Taylor, where are you going to get the truth? So, you know, stick up for Phil. Put your money where your mouth is, Toronto.
Well, thank you, Thomas. With blushes, I accept.
Okay.
We'll see you then.
Okay,
bye-bye. That's Thomas Mountain, and he's right. The new sound of your city, you know, CAT membership drive. Thomas is right on top of it. He may be in Eritrea, but he knows what's going on in Toronto. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will come back and talk with, I believe, it's Robin Philpott.